Hi, listeners. I want to tell you about a cause that I'm involved with at Heritage Radio Network. HRN is celebrating its 15th year, and to celebrate, we're deepening our commitment to giving voice to the next generation of food system storytellers, and we need your help. Our internship and fellowship programs help activate new possibilities for underrepresented and underestimated young people through experiential journalism, audio engineering, and production training. Through these unique programs, HRN helps food equity stewards build essential workforce readiness skills that expand their potential and foster economic mobility. Please consider supporting these critical programs. And with a minimum donation, you can be entered to win a dinner for two at an amazing restaurant in one of eight cities and tickets to a concert at a great venue in one of those cities. We have incredible partners across the country who have donated, as they also share our passion for helping to educate the next generation of food system storytellers. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. And make sure you donate before March 31st. Thank you.
Hey everyone, it's Cam Hurt, host of the Best Show Ever podcast, and we have got a second season coming out very soon that I am very excited about. We've got some very cool special guests, including musical acts that we all love, like Karina Reichman, Daniel Donato, Jake Brownstein from Eggy, Rick and Peter from Goose, and many more. Tune in for new episodes dropping on Osiris Media March 5th on the Best Show Ever podcast.
Osiris.
What's going on? It's me, Karina Reichman, coming to you live, actually from the city of brotherly love, Philadelphia, and I'm joined once again by my dear pal, my co-conspirator, my mainest dude, Isaac Sloan. But we have a very special guest today. This is just wildly exciting. My dear friend, a tickler of ivories, a consumer of shellfish,
chairman of the board.
Chairman of many things, actually. We have Aaron Magner joining us from the Disco Biscuits, among other things. Hi, Aaron.
Hi, guys. It's so nice to be here.
It's so mutual. Thanks for taking the time.
Of
after
course.
We just did something pretty big, wouldn't you say?
That was the biggest seafood tower I think I've ever partaken in.
It was pretty next level. We had a seafood tower at acclaimed Philadelphia restaurant Park, P-A-R-C. Not bad. Not shabby.
For our listeners, I don't partake in the seafood love, so I just watch these guys and their respective loved ones crush a three-tier seafood tower.
Which worked for us great.
It was amazing. You know, it worked for me, by the way.
Yeah.
I really had a great time.
You don't dig on any of that. It's amazing that your friendship has survived with Karina and you don't do the oysters or the shellfish or anything.
It's one of the few places that we come at a crossroads, but I really love her love of seafood and have watched it, you know, grow from just something that she experienced to something you could auction off a chance to eat a seafood tower with Karina. I don't know if you know about this.
They
raised money for the Freaks Action Network.
I love that.
It's been a thing that has, it's been auctioned off a few times. Where
Andy Bernstein once.
He won once, which was great news because it was a pal of mine. That was fantastic. I was so happy he just kept bidding. Thanks.
How many shuckers do you have in your phone?
Quite a few.
You're loyal to one.
I'm loyal to one. Shout out to my dear friend Dave Siegel over at Cullen Pistol. If you're ever in New York, people, listen. Run.
Don't walk.
Over to Cullen Pistol. It's in Chelsea Market. Famous Chelsea Market. He's my mainest dude. My co-conspirator for many things as well. I love this guy. He's a wonderful dude and a huge music fan. But, you know, across the country, we got you know, some people have hoes in different area codes. I definitely have shuckers in different area codes.
Well, we have shared oysters a few times now.
That's
you know?
True.
It's like becoming a thing.
You see?
It makes both of us happy, and so therefore it's becoming a thing. I think most recently I surprised, my wife and I brought you surprise oysters to the Ardmore Music Hall.
Was good.
Yeah.
Now that was really good. Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. I mean, it's great when people know that you like a specific thing. Yeah. You know, I always say, I'm not very complicated. I'm not a complicated girl on the inside. You know, I like music. I like shellfish. I like the ocean. That's sort of it, you know? And when you, you know, you keep it confined, and then you know what would make me really stoked is when you show up at my gig with...
I'm simple like that, too. It takes very little to make me happy.
It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah,
I'm wildly complex. It actually takes a lot to make me happy.
Oh, my Lord. Well, it was great to break crab legs with you this morning.
Yeah, yeah.
Really fantastic. And so,
this morning, 1:30 in the afternoon. But the other thing is we're on Fish Tour.
Which is a beautiful thing. And actually, before Fish Tour, we were on Dead and Company Tour.
We've just been seeing a lot of each other in the last week. It's rather nice.
And even before that, Aaron, you came to a very important party for your girl. Do you remember this?
Oh, I do. So why was I up in New York? I was up in New York last Thursday, and then you gave me a call. Yo, are you up in New York yet? And I was like, I am. And you were like, you need to check out my new digs. Come to my new studio. It's awesome.
And was I wrong?
No, you were definitely not wrong. It was impressive. It was impressive, number one, that there are so many creatives in that space that you can tell that this was going to be a great place for you to like work out of and, you know, have your next phase of your career come out of that small little room. But the creativity that exists in that space, really, I mean, it permeates the walls. You know, there are so many seemingly talented and smart and at least organized people. I don't know any of them. You introduced me to a lot of people who's, I don't remember any of their names.
No problem.
And even the names of, you're like, oh, he's produced everything in the last year, including, and then you like listed off like all these people that I had no idea who you were talking about, but it seemed impressive.
Sure.
And they had really, I mean, it's New York, right? So all rooms are kind of like small and you got to make the best out of, you know, the small square footage, but everything was clean and the hardware that they had was all impressive. They were really making it work in that kind of like space. And the shared space I thought was just like so cool as a collective of artists and creatives that I wish you the best of luck in that room.
Thanks, Aaron. For those of you who don't know, which is everybody, we're talking about a place here that I've found myself in, and it's called Kensaltown East. And it's called Kensaltown East because there's already just a Kensaltown, and it's in London. And it is owned by a gentleman who I might have introduced you to named Martin. I still don't know if it's Tarefe or Tarefe, but it's T-E-R-E-F-E. Everybody Google him.
Does it have an accent, the aigu?
It does not.
The last E?
It does not.
Is that the right aigu? I just said that.
Aigu.
Is that a thing?
Aigu. Yeah, totally.
Huh.
I know. You've been hanging out with my mother or
I
what?
I don't know. Seventh grade French just opened up.
Très bon, mon petit. C'est bon, mon petit. C'est bon. No, my boy Martin has this... my boy Martin, LOL. He is a... wildly recognized and prolific record producer. And this gentleman is, you know, he co-wrote Hey Soul Sister by Train. He's worked on Train Records, Jason Mraz, KT Tunstall, Coldplay. Like, he's got accolades on accolades and just, you know, was like, oh, I want a artist collective studio place in New York for when I go several months out of the year. And he... made that happen. And that's...
So he has like the large room there? I mean, there must have been 15, 20 different rooms, right?
He has... It's the whole space is his. So it's co-owned by him and a gentleman named Camus, a.k.a. Camus, if we're speaking not in French. So Camus, who's also a very, you know, successful record producer, Nile Rodgers' right-hand guy for many, many years, and he's a wildly talented engineer. So basically, the partnership between Camus and Martin resulted in Kensaltown East, which is on Irving Place, one of my favorite streets in New York City as well, which is incredible. And yeah, it's basically... they have artists in residence, if you will. I am one of them. I have a room there that Magner came and saw at this, and it was basically the opening party is
right,
what you came
right
to. So I've been working out of there since December.
Mm-hmm.
But
on
my debut record.
I did hear a few songs from that debut record.
Ah,
My, when is that record coming out? Those songs are good. I know they're not like 100% at the finish line, but they're right there.
We're ready.
So what can you disclose?
I can disclose very little, and actually we're already just fucking, we're getting ahead of ourselves, but I can disclose that you play on a song.
I do.
Which is really great. And that's about all I can disclose.
Okay.
I've been doing podcasts and dropping hints and telling the people that I'm working on a larger body of work, which I desperately need because right now I'm Six Singles Reichman out here.
Six Singles
somehow
Reichman.
Doing all of these illustrious things. I don't know why. And I'm always blown away that people come to the shows, book me at the festivals, et cetera, but I'm wildly proud.
So is that your set list? Like those six songs
those
and a
six,
cover or two?
Those six always appear because to me, I'm like, if I'm Six Singles Reichman, right? God forbid.
You gotta play the hits.
Somebody comes. If somebody has heard, if somebody has heard one of these six songs and I don't play them at the concert, that's not cool, right? Like,
sure.
I don't know, at least for now.
Sure, sure.
And know. Then you get more songs in the
people
repertoire.
Aren't going to know where City Kids walk unless you tell them and remind them.
You just have to let them know exactly what we're all about in the 212 Mean Streets. So yes, that a cover too. And we've been playing tunes off of this yet to be released.
Ah, that's fun.
Record for sure. And you know, kind of easing in there. And also things that won't appear on the record that are originals and whatnot.
So are you able to tell from the crowd, you know, the one of the six singles that they definitely recognize versus one of the new songs that they haven't heard yet when you start to slip it in?
Certainly. And you also see it the more you do it, right? Where it's like the first time I played, okay, guys, you've seen it. It's all, you know, who am I to be so coy? There's a song called Joyride. I've been playing it and opening with it for the last 3 months. So, when, you know, the first few times I played Joyride, I just maybe being less comfortable in it myself, you know what I mean? You sort of look out and you're like, oh, like, are people digging this? I don't know. Are they? Whatever. But now I embody it when I play it, you know what I mean? That I'm just like comfortable and confident in, you know, the deploying of the tune. That I'm like, oh, shit. And then now you see people who are getting down. I'm like, oh, awesome. I don't know. Maybe they heard it somewhere.
Well, I'll say this without disclosing anything. I've heard now four or five songs from that album, and it's phenomenal. But most especially just like how excited you are for this project and how excited we are to kind of like help support you on this, like, you know, next chapter that you're about to write. And that's kind of what this is all about, whether it's like the scene or life or friendship or whatever it is. It's about supporting each other, but it's especially about like when you find somebody that you know has like a, you know, an X factor or whatever the word would be, and be like, oh, let's like all blow some wind for, you know, her magical journey that, like, you know, she could soar. And, you know, I feel that way about you. I do.
Aww. You're going to make me cry on my own podcast. That's so great.
Nobody can see.
Nobody can see. I'm shedding a few tears. Thanks, Aaron. I really appreciate it. No, and it's honestly, it's a testament to this small pocket of the world that I've found myself in musically and with people like you, among others, in this sort of, call it jam band circuit, call it what you will. People are unequivocally kind.
Yeah.
And I, you know, as if the ravenous fans and the people who come back to see you and buy tickets and merch weren't already enough, the fact that the players are so embracing, or at least they have been of me, you know, since I was a, you know, dipshit 20-year-old doing whatever, you know what I mean? And now I'm just like, wow, this people are so fucking awesome, you know? And I feel like it's not necessarily like that in every subgenre of music. And I don't know, I'm very pleased to have found myself in this one.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I don't see our community kind of like as a competitive community.
No.
Right? There, you know, definitely is, right? You know, like, did we do better than Umphrey's at that venue? Oh, we did great. You know, like, there's definitely that type of like competition.
That's hot goss, guys. That's hot goss.
We you know, we love and support each other. But Dan Berkowitz talks about this all the time in the country scene, that, you know, built into their ethos that they're actually like, you know, secularly supporting each other. So, you know, the opener that nobody knows goes out with the headliner, you know, Garth Brooks, whatever.
Sure.
And then, you know, that opener that nobody knew, everybody knows, and 2 years later, they're the headliner, takes out a no-known opener, and, like, you know, they're constantly, like, you know, fanning the flame or whatever the terminology would be to help, you know, keep this amazingly vibrant country scene alive.
Sure.
You know, but that's part of, like, their, you know, their marketing or their branding or how they deal with it, you know, themselves within that little niche market, that huge niche market of country music. You know, so it's kind of nice to, and one of Dan's points that he's been making is it would be nice if the jam band scene started, like, you know, borrowing that mentality a little bit, right?
Sure.
Like, they're very open about that's what they do in the country world. But in the jam band world, you know, like, hey, we're seeing Phish again tonight, you know, we love Phish. Not knocking Phish, but, like, they haven't had an opener, like, ever, like, since, like, you know, 1994 when they played Horde or whatever. I don't know the stats, right?
Even earlier, you know? Yeah, totally.
And now you're starting to see, like, you know, Trey sitting in with, you know, Billy Strings and Goose and Pigeons. I don't know. Has he done all these things yet?
Well, just the first two. Leave it at the first two. But yes. But yes.
You know? So is that, like, is that deliberate? Is he just, like, trying to have fun? Is he trying to, like, you know, just again, you know, get some wind picking up for these younger bands to keep the scene, the next generation, vibrant? Like, I don't know whether that's deliberate and intentional of what he's doing, but I think that it could only have positive effects.
I think it certainly is intentional and deliberate in a beautiful and not self-serving way.
Right.
I really feel that way. And I had a great talk with Trey's dad at the show yesterday about this very subject and how, you know, he's like, when you get older, meaning Karina, you'll see that there will be younger musicians that are just getting their start, and it will be your responsibility too to bring them in and give them what all these people have given you.
Yeah.
And which I feel very strongly about. And, like, it's so funny. Now I'm like 28, right? It's like, I'm not old, but, like, I see now younger musicians, and I never thought I'd be like, oh, I have to help them, but I do. And, like, well, who the fuck am I to help anybody? I don't fucking know. What am I barely know my ass from my elbow myself, you know what I mean? But, like, you know, I see younger musicians and I'm like, oh, I gotta give them the amp head that I'm not using. I need to, what, how, where, how can I help? Like, and I do sort of already feel that almost, you know, whatever you can call it, impulse, right? Yeah. So I can only imagine if you are of, you know, the stature, and you know, you're Trey, right? You can really help somebody in this world, you know, and give them eyes on them, you know?
100%. Or even, like, you know, in, like, almost an academic way. So I had the honor of playing with Carlos Santana last summer, and we got to hang out for the day after we played some music, and he was playing us Pharoah Sanders, right? Like, not just like, oh, check out this track. It was like, hey, check out this album. And, you know, sat us down and played us this whole album. And he was very, like, erudite with the things that he was passing along to us just about music and the stories that the other musicians, you know, had told him when he was younger. And it's amazing, right? It's like, oh man, yeah, Miles told me this, you know? And it's like, wait, like, Miles Davis told you what, you know?
Yeah.
And it was a very, like, it was just, we were all ears as he was just telling us stories, but, like, kind of like a little musical education about, like, you know, things that we should know, but when you hear it from a person that's been in this, you know, industry for so long, you know, minimalism, holding out a note until it stretches to infinity, you know, seeing the beauty of, like, one sustained note, seeing the beauty of not playing any note and just listening, seeing the beauty of the interaction musically with other players, and having this conversation with us, and as amazing and lovely as the experience was, and I took a lot away from it, what I also realized is that I think it felt like a responsibility that he had to do the same things that, like, you know, the masters, you know, of decades ago, of a generation, two generations ago, you know, had taught a young Carlos Santana that had stayed with him for so many years, and now passing on, you know, as he's in his, you know, last phase of life. I don't know what the right way of phrasing that
sure.
is. You know, and making sure that that gets handed down to, you know, another generation of musicians, you know, that, like, hopefully I can still tell the stories of what, you know, Carlos said to me that was so, like, powerful and amazing, and, you know, another couple of decades when I'm talking to younger kids. But I think that that's, like, a responsibility of really any older generation, right? You know, like, oral history type of thing.
Certainly. And ours just happens to be rallied around music, which is the best thing ever, you know? And it's funny you mentioned Carlos specifically, because Trey has told me, you know, Fish opened for Santana in what, 1992, Isaac? 91?
Yeah, 92.
Around there. And Carlos pulled Trey up every single night and had him sit in.
That's right.
And Trey was, he, you know, told me, he was like, you know, Carlos Santana pulled me up on stage every single night and let me play for his fans, you know, and I, at the time, could not understand why he did that for me. I could not understand why he would be so generous and, you know, do something so profound for me. But then he's like, now that I've gotten older and I've had the career that I've had and the accolades that I've had, I feel that exact same responsibility.
Yeah, that.
And I really understand that on some kind of, even though I'm just beginning, you know what I mean? But, like, I can see it. I can see that us doing this thing, it's fucking important. I mean, it's important to me, you know what I mean? And, like, just to keep it going. And if you don't do that, the genre dies, right? And people playing real instruments, fuck, we have to keep it going.
Right. You know? I mean, right, especially in the art form that, you know, that, like, it is an oral history, yeah. Both. So about that Santana and Trey thing. So what did I hear the other day? I cannot confirm this because I heard it secondhand, but perhaps you can if you're the statistician, Isaac. So on that tour, when he was bringing Trey up every night, that one of the last nights of the tour, he brought all of Fish up. Do you know of which I refer?
I don't know. I know he played with all of Fish. I don't know if that was on Santana time or
so. The story that I had heard is that, like, on this last night that Trey had been coming up every night, that he brought all of Fish up, thinking that, you know, they were going to get on their respective instruments, and, you know, Fish being Fish, and God bless them, Fishman played his vacuum cleaner for, like, an ungodly amount of time, and there was, like, stink eye going on, like, across stage, both from Santana as well from Trey. Like, dude.
It's like, holy shit.
Dude.
Tell you, for a band that's tried to subvert, you know, their success at every turn, they've really turned out all right.
It's really true.
You know? Which,
I mean, they try, right? They really try. I don't think they're trying to subvert their success. I think that they feel confident enough in themselves as, you know, a collective artist that they have the freedom to try whatever the fuck they want to try, and an audience that is embracing enough to let them have that freedom.
Well,
and that's beautiful.
You have to imagine if Santana's throwing down the Pharoah Sanders record and is saying, we need to appreciate this, he will get Fishman's vacuum cleaner, because if he's talking about a musical tradition, Pharoah Sanders, very experimental.
Without a doubt.
I'm sorry. I don't think that I can draw this parallel of experimental Pharoah Sanders and John Fishman vacuum cleaner. Interesting. Okay. Yeah. Hey.
I can.
I think
it's
a stretch,
I can.
But I hear you. I hear the point.
You know what I mean? I feel you with that. 100%. I feel
Pharoah Sanders, very subversive for his time.
But I think that he was... In what type of, like, seriousness is Fishman playing his instrument?
Serious enough to do it on stage with Carlos Santana.
Serious enough to do it on stage with Carlos Santana.
Oh, damn.
Yeah.
He did it.
I'm not saying it's to draw a total parallel, but I do think, you know, there are these kinds of crevices of the musical tradition that don't get passed down. They actually get a little bit ironed out. And it's important to kind of rile that up, and I think that's part of Fish's success.
Totally. In that, like, in the silliness of the tradition, the Frank Zappa, the even the Sun Ra, you know, the having a little bit of hubris in your music, even though you might be a master of your instrument, that you're still, you know, can be self-deprecating and having fun, and you know, nothing's all that serious, you know, especially if you're like a jazzer, right? Yeah. You know, you can like play circles around most everybody else that like, you know, on, you know, your instrument, but like, you need to not take yourself so seriously as a master of your instrument and get up there and play a fucking vacuum cleaner.
Right.
You
know? Or and, open a sold out show at the Man with a acapella tune.
Right.
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 Which like is beautiful. Night. Like we saw last night, which was fantastic. And I agree, you know, the fact that there's the audience for it, right, that drinks it up and allows them, it just, the audience to band just keeps emboldening each other, I feel like, which is what you just said yep. before. But, you know, you gotta love that. And that, to me, as somebody who drinks this all up with great pleasure and tries to reproduce it in my own ways, you know, it's just, it's the freedom that gets me.
Yep.
It's the freedom to try and to be eclectic, weird as fuck, funny, stupid, all of these things that, like, you know, a lot of people in other genres don't definitely take themselves far too seriously to, shall we say, fuck around and find out, you know?
Yeah.
And they have built a beautiful 30-plus year career on fucking around and finding out. And, man, last night was good. That was great. And so we're at the party in New York. Do you remember? We're there. That was Thursday. Friday, we didn't see each other. Saturday.
Wait.
Talked. What do you got?
On the evening that you guys hung out.
I can't believe that I didn't get, like, every variation of COVID and monkeypox and poxes that haven't even come out yet. I mean, there were so many people in such a closed, confined space, like, that were all, like, in their 20s and 30s, you know?
We were having a party within a party, for those of you. Like, let me reproduce the scene, right? There's like maybe 150 to 200 people at this party, right? It's an enormous space. Square footage, don't even fucking know the number. Who gives a fuck? It's large. It's all happening. But I have a room there. Less large. Not large. And there's about 15 people in my room, which really should comfortably seat about 4. And that's when they're sitting. If that. Really, truly. So we're there and blah, blah, blah. Magner's coming. I pick him up off the elevator. It's just full bacchanalia, lunacy people. I don't know any of that. It was all happening. We go to the bartender who recognizes you, which was the best part,
the
actually.
Bartender.
Do you remember this?
I don't know why I emphasize that so little, but I kind of like it.
That bartender was like pouring a drink and then he looks up and he's like, oh my God, Maggie Max. I am a huge fan, B4L. And we were and I pissed myself. I was like, oh my God, this is the best. And he's just like, yo, man, I'm from Philly, you know? And I'm like, oh shit, the bartender knows.
And that was the only time I got recognized that night.
Well, again, this place, I feel like it's a beautiful thing to me. And you tell me if you ever experienced this, maybe you don't. I don't know. I love feeling like a small fish in a big pond.
Sure.
And that's exactly what I feel like there because I am in this other sort of world. But then they like, you know, because I go on tour and then I come back and they're all like, dude, what? You were doing what with who in this thing? And I saw the pictures and it looked insane. And I'm like, oh, yeah, you know, I'm like a road dog. I'm not a studio rat cranking out what you guys are cranking out. But like, I do something, you know, and they're just like, damn. So it's like sort of this mutual admiration over there with these people who like make top 40 hits.
I mean, I think that probably is going to like up your game, you know, whether you like have conversations and you pick up little pieces from like what those amazing producers are doing in the other studio or whether it's just like you now hold yourself to a higher caliber because you are in a really professional space that you got to like pump out, you know, you're no longer Six Single Carino over here, you know, you're Six Single Carino plus like, when's this fucking album going to come out?
Right. There's definitely that.
Bonnaroo and all kinds of, you know, like so many.
Which at least they speak, you know what
they
I mean?
Speak,
like when I say I came back from Bonnaroo, they don't go, wait, you know, it's not like when I say I came back from, you know, the Dunkaroo in the woods, which is what we call the cold burgers and warm beer festivals that I usually play, you know what I mean?
Dunkaroos?
Well, yeah, Dunkaroos. Dunkaroo Fest. Fucking Dunkaroo Fest.
We have those on our rider.
Do you? Yeah. I bet. I do too, pal.
It's a new addition to the rider. It's really fun.
Oh, like Dunkaroos.
Like actual Dunkaroos.
Oh,
yeah.
Got it.
Yeah,
understood.
Like the kangaroo that you dip in chocolate.
You see, I thought you meant, you know, you just play shiesty festivals like me, but of course not.
Wait. I slowed the roll on the order of events because on the night you guys hung out.
Yes, sir.
At midnight, this gentleman put out a tune with his band, the Disco Biscuits.
Oh, dude. And then we have been spinning it non Stop.
Oh, that's where all those plays are coming from?
Dude, it's us. Oh. And it's my father, actually. Shout out to John Reichman, who...
Rock Candy.
Oh.
He loves Rock
he
Candy.
He loves Rock Candy.
I know.
And he is a... I love that story. He is a 76-year-old philosopher, you know, who writes books and gives lectures and teaches at Columbia University and is an absolute sponge for music that I show him. And in high school, I showed him many things, of which the Disco Biscuits were one. And he comes, you know, comes in from his 5-mile walk, you know, after writing all morning and drinking 2 French presses and whatever. And then he comes and takes his little Apple headphones out and goes, oh, Rock Candy.
Rock Candy.
Oh. And I'm like, yeah, Pa, you know what's going on. So he also loves Who's in Charge, which is the real seal of approval you want.
Now, is he critical? Is there some music that you introduced to him saying, hey, you need to listen to it, that doesn't necessarily jive with him?
Certainly, in the sense of, like, I can show him something and be like, huh, well, it's not really for me, but, you know, whatever. But
it's like, it's no Rock Candy.
It's no Rock Candy. Exactly. No, he loves, you know what he loves is 2001, the Dr. Dre record. You know, he comes in, you know, blasting Housewife. He's like, yeah, okay. You know, he loves anything, and he loves Afrobeat music. That's his new kind of, he walks around and zones out to all that, which is great. But back in the day, he was like really enjoying Four on the Floor, pulsing. You know, he was listening to Mastercraft and Chromeo and you guys. And like all.
It's fun music.
It's
you know?
Fun music. Yeah. And I think it's good when you do such heady work to have such a consistent pulse.
I agree.
You know what I mean? Yeah, exactly.
As someone who does heady work.
It's pretty cool, right? I think it takes you out of your kind of, you know, overly complicated thoughts somehow and just gets you to where you need to be. I don't know. I feel like
he's a philosopher. Overly complicated thoughts.
The thoughts are overly complicated sometimes.
But like he stays within like French philosophy from 1600 to 1650.
Someone was listening at the Dead and Company show when I was describing this to you.
I can't believe I still had that sense.
That was good. Really, from 1965 to present, you know, that's more the era. But yes.
Oh, 1965. This is not like...
Not 1600.
No, we're talking, you know, continental French philosophy is sort of his, you know, his bread and butter, basically. But, you know, this guy, he's a deep cat, you know. Anyway.
And he likes Who's in Charge, so I like him.
Exactly. So about Who's in Charge, the fuck, dude? Why you gotta do us like that? So dirty, because it's fucking dirty and we love it.
Yeah,
it's really fantastic.
There's stuff that's a brewing, you know. We're in a really positive and creative spot right now with this band that we haven't been able to be in for unnecessarily long, but we're here right now and we're kind of like exploring it. And what's nice is that, you know, we're trying not to overthink it, right? So I mean, you know, when putting out music, like it's never done,
never,
you know. And sometimes it like takes somebody else to be like give you a deadline so it has to be done, right? In our case, we don't necessarily have a deadline. The only deadline is like, enough, let's move on to the next song, you know. So like on this Thursday, John and I are getting together again, and it's like blank slate. We're starting, you know, with the blank slate again, right? So I went over to his house yesterday to kind of like put some finishing touches on what will be the next single, which will ship and come out probably in a month or 2 months or something like that, just so we can keep this ball rolling. It's a ball that like is rewarding to us, it's rewarding to the fans. You know, new music is constantly coming out, we're getting to explore it on stage, we're getting to tap into an audience presumably that, you know, hasn't been exposed to the Disco Biscuits before, so we're feeding that, and most importantly, we're getting back some sort of like collaborative artistic force that like we haven't felt in a while, you know. And the fact that the fans are so receptive to it, because that's always a difficult one, right? Like you're like, here's our new song, we're really excited to play our new song, we like, you know, really spent a lot of time with it, and it's called whatever, and then you go play it and everybody's like, I don't know this song, and I don't really care about this song because I don't know it. And that's usually the reaction. And then of course, you know, new songs eventually become old songs, and everybody, you know, loves it once it's an old song, and there'll be another new song, and people don't like it until it becomes an old song. That's typically the, you know, this Sisyphean kind of like release strategy that always happens in music. But for this, we're getting the immediate satisfaction of this fan feedback of like, these are great. And part of it, I'm sure, is that they actually see how reinvigorated we are on stage, you know? And then you have that secular effect of like, you know, well, we're psyched, we're smiling, and then the fans are psyched and they're smiling. So like, all we do is just send that around. And, you know, for me, and what my role is in this band dynamic wise, you know, outside of like, you know, creatively and putting music in, is to try and deliberately keep that energy of positivity flowing, you know, and make sure that like all the portals and the doors are just open, you know, and I can't necessarily force that positivity and that energy to continue to flow. But what I can do is make sure that it's not like that I'm not doing anything to block it and that I'm doing everything to help facilitate it. And it's kind of like a new perspective that I've had of like what my role is in this band outside of like, I play keyboards and I like to write music and I like to collaborate, you know. It's like, oh, okay, I have at 47, how old am I? We figured this out. I'm still 46.
You're still 46. Still 46. Don't rush it. Don't rush it.
I'm not rushing it, but like every time I swear that I'm 47 and she says 46 and like I don't believe it. Literally, like I just got gifted another year of life.
It's beautiful.
Amazing. Anyway, so my perspective on life is different now than it was 10 years ago, as I'm sure it will be in another, you know, 10 years. You know, you look at somebody like Carlos Santana and the wisdom that, you know, he has, and I'm sure he had wisdom when he was my age too, but he has the wisdom of a, you know, 77-year-old man, right? You know, I've got newfound perspective and wisdom, if I might use that word, you know, of a 46-year-old that is definitely different than I had at 36. And I'm kind of like enjoying it now that I'm like aware and playing into it, you know, like, oh, these are positive attributes about my personality and about like what my contributions are in life, to the world, to my family, to my band, and let me lean into that. So
incredible.
Yeah, I feel invigorated hearing about it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I told my psychologist exciting. The other day, I was like, I think I'm done.
I love the idea of being, you know, the member of the band that keeps things positive, doesn't block things from happening, and just kind of keeps things rolling and everybody's stoked on the fucking eyes on the prize, whatever that might be or whatever. Like, I think that's such a great, you know, piece of the puzzle to be. You know?
So I don't think that I am the only person in the
band. Of course not. No, God forbid. God forbid we say that. No, no, no. That's not what we mean.
Yeah,
of course
and
not.
It's kind of, I mean, and here's like the life lesson is like, you know, just, and again, with this like 30,000 foot perspective of just like, it's so much easier to concentrate on like, you know, negative things or the little things that bother you. And you kind of like lose perspective of like the bigger picture, what you want to accomplish. And you focus on some sort of minutia that definitely doesn't matter in the long run. And if you're able to kind of like just acknowledge that, right? You're not trying to ignore it, you know, you can acknowledge that. And once you, you know, label it as whatever it is, then you could like move on to what you know is a grander perspective. You know, in this case, it's, you know, I want my band to have as long of a career and prosperous career as possible, right? And there's like a lot of, you know, ups and downs along the way, and, you know, a COVID shutdown and an industry thing and the after effects of COVID and, you know, ticket prices being high and, you know, people deciding, you know, more deliberately where they want to spend their ticket money, we were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
But like throughout all of this, you know, we'll get through that stuff. We'll have to pivot somewhere along the way, and we might not know what the answer is to these, you know, crazy high ticket prices and inflation and, you know, what venues we should play and, you know, strategy and all that. That's all part of the big picture. But like the end goal is that, you know, I want to still be doing this in, you know, it doesn't have to be the same capacity, but a similar capacity. I want to continue to explore music, you know, whether it's, you know, hopefully with my band or with another band that I feel equally as, you know, gratified for getting to play music with. And I want to do that for as long as possible. So, you know, whatever I can do now to help kind of like facilitate that. And that has been an eye-awakening thing for me in the last year.
Wow. And then, so, you know, looking back to when you joined the Disco Biscuits, you're how old? Young, 20 something?
Not
younger.
Even, 19.
Sure. And having, you know, being that guy, right? And having, you know, the hindsight not at all because it's just beginning and whatnot, you know what I mean? I think it's really interesting to be at the point you are now with the illustrious and spectacular career that you guys have had. And have sort of, you know, the knowledge of fucking what is going to keep this going. New music, excited fans, excited band,
yep.
people with
yep.
unblocked chi,
yep.
you know?
Exactly.
And have it keep going. And, you know, to be able to not only know that, but act on it, it's the hardest thing. And right. you guys are doing it. And you're putting these songs into play, as we know, as fans and, you know, happy spectators and friends of yours and, you know, the other guys. It's just a beautiful thing to see.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. You know, and there's like so many things. There's like jumping into the deep end and just like, you know, having faith that it will yield for, you know, something successful, right? So John was really pushing us on this last tour. He was kind of fatiguing of playing the songs that we'd been playing for, you know, decades at this point, and was just like, you know, almost what's the word I'm looking for? He really like only wanted to play new music, right? And was like, okay, well, you know, you have to have like some sort of the hybrid. But he was kind of like pushing us to be like, we need to play. We have eight, you know, eight shows left this month. I want to play one new song, you know, each night, even though they were clearly not ready for prime time. You know, they were like not complete. We hadn't had a chance to really like, you know, get together and work it out in the practice room before doing it on stage. But we all knew how excited he was to like at least try. So rather than, you know, Fish has like the yes and mentality, and this is like our version of like borrowing from that, rather than, you know, pushing against that, you know, with the things that I'm sure that John has thought about. Yes, we're not ready for it yet. Yes, we need to practice. Oh, I feel uncomfortable. I don't know the song. I need my charts, you know, all that stuff. We did it, and we did it without the anxiety that typically is associated with that, you know, whether it's working ourselves up, you know, and like, you know, complaining to our wives that I'm not ready yet, or whether it's, you know, trying to find like another musician in the band that's like, yo, this is a bad idea, right? Like, you're not ready, I'm not ready, you know, and then like forming an alliance. And we all just kind of like did whatever internal work we needed to do to kind of be like, fuck it. You know, and that's sort of what we were talking about earlier with Fish, is like, you know, fuck it. Like, we have an audience that like are accepting of us for who we are, right? And it did feel like, you know, this is me without any clothes on, like, you know, and to be able to like have that type of like freedom, you know, is a beautiful thing, you know, to be able to know that my band is going to like come in as prepared as possible, you know, without like, you know, hours and hours of practice, to have the fans be there and be as attentive and opening and receptive as possible. It was nice. So now here we are, like, you know, reaping the rewards of that, you know, and now trying to push it forward with like, cool, that worked, let's continue to do this.
It's the sickest shit of all time. Yeah. And just having the freedom and the comfortability to be like, this is us, raw, uncut, alive, working on new shit for y'all, for us. We're keeping it going. It is a beautiful thing.
And then you get to see the creative process, yeah. right? Like, you know, you get to see the raw at first, and then, you know, the next time it becomes a little less raw, but it's still there.
Sure.
You know, and by whatever, 10 times later, you know, it starts to form a song. And like, that's kind of cool too. Like, it's like watching like Bob Ross, you know, paint a fucking happy tree, and you're like, what? Like, he just dabbed his paintbrush in, and now like that's a whole like Yosemite scene. Like, what's up with that?
And one thing leads to another.
Did
yeah.
I just compared the Disco Biscuits to Bob Ross, but sort Dude. Of, right? Our improvisations can kind of be like that, you know?
I see Bob Ross a lot when I'm at your shows, actually. What's that about?
We used to have family, like a really calming, tranquil period of time. It was like last winter or something, where my kids sort of got into it, and then we were like, this is a nice like pre-bedtime thing, and the kids would like take their shower, bath, and then we'd all get into bed together and watch like two or three episodes of Bob Ross in a row.
Wow.
It was nice.
Was it nice?
Nice. My wife is sitting beside me.
She says it was beautiful.
It was calming.
It was very calming. I can only imagine. That's literally spectacular.
Did you bust out the paints and paint together?
No, and our littles are definitely you know, visual creators. You know, that's like whatever creativity that has been, you know, passed down through their genes is definitely expressed through visual arts. But yeah, they did not bust out the paints and try and paint along with it. You know, we got him like a little doll that has like a Bob Ross like bobblehead doll or something like that. And then I found out all about like who owns the Bob Ross Corporation. Felt a little bit weird about that. So
I don't know that.
You can't win them all. You really can't win them all.
It's a document. It's a Bob Ross documentary. Oh, gotcha. It's pretty good. Yeah, gotcha.
I'm not so deep on Bob Ross.
There's an evil Bob Ross like empire that like, you know, had him sign over his shit like on his deathbed kind of. Mm. Yeah.
Dude, I mean, we're all just out here with these creative fucking pursuits, whether we're Bob Ross or we're your son Eli or you or me or Isaac.
Carlos Santana.
Or Carlos Santana. We're all just trying to put one little tree in front of another and make a lot of big trees.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
You know?
But that's what all of us on this planet are trying to do, right?
100%.
We're just doing it with music and think that, like, you know, we're getting some more reward out of it because it's like, you know, we're making art and beauty, you know, which we are, and it's awesome that we feel that way, but that's what everybody's doing, just putting one foot in front of you know, another, hopefully pursuing happiness and, you know, pursuing, like, making other people happy in whatever you can do. Yeah,
it's the best you can do, man. Yeah. It's the best you can do. It's a beautiful message. It's a beautiful message for the people, the listeners. Hi, listeners. How you doing? Isaac, do you have any burning questions that we haven't covered for our friend Aaron? Or are we going to put a bow on this motherfucking thing? What are you thinking?
I think this was really complete and beautiful. I think I really enjoyed this conversation. Great episode of Inappropriate Happiness.
Oh, can we rebrand it appropriate happiness for this episode?
This was appropriate.
This is appropriate.
I couldn't agree more. Yeah. I mean, really, truly, like we said, we've seen a lot of each other in the last week. I'm appropriately happy about that. I think it's fantastic. We've been at parties, at Dead and Company shows together, at Fish shows together, at brasseries. And right now we are at my dear friend's home on Rittenhouse Square.
I mean, this is really spectacular. Can you just describe the setting that we're in right now? Because it is rather special.
We should. You're absolutely right. Before we sign off. So, you know, sometimes you meet interesting people doing what we do.
There's no explaining this.
I have a very dear friend named Dr. Joe, who is a dentist, who has a house that is also a dentistry practice on Rittenhouse Square in Philadelphia. And, you know, the first level and the basement level is where dentistry occurs. And then he has lived here and raised two daughters, and him and his wife are both dentists who practice downstairs. Mm-hmm. And they live on the top floor. And I have been very lucky to stay here just about every time I've ever played Philadelphia with Marco or my band or whoever. And whenever
this
I come to
spot.
Philly, this is my spot. So thank you for joining us. And we're at the, I don't know, I like to call it the debauchery room, but that's maybe a little too debauched for what it is. It's, you know, there's a bar, there's a pool table, we're on a leather couch. We have, you know, what I call the widow's watch outside where, you know, glass doors open to a stone carved balcony that overlooks Rittenhouse Square.
I feel like this is like where if you would have told me that like the first five presidents of the United States of America lived in this building, I would be like, oh my God, of course. Like,
absolutely.
That's amazing. Yeah.
It's classic. Like that. It's a real vibe. I have recorded one other podcast here before. I was a guest on somebody else's and they came here to record me. This is maybe 3 or 4 years ago. And they were also wildly shocked by the environs. So it's nice to, you know, bring someone into our little corner of the world here on Inappropriate Happiness. Live at Rittenhouse Square, see? And we like to say it like that, actually. We could go, Rittenhouse Square, see? You'll never catch me, copper.
If you can hear the doors of the glass doors to the, you know, nice balcony just opened and the ghosts of past presidents are now sitting in.
Yeah.
Past presidents and past teeth, you know? The teeth, you know, fucking, you can't hold them all forever, you know what I'm saying? It's unbelievable. So a really beautiful place to conduct business, dentistry, podcasts, good times.
I like how beautiful is the word to describe. It's just like this has been a beautiful conversation in a beautiful home.
Amongst beautiful friends.
It's very appropriate, and we're just evolving.
Yeah, that's sort of the vibe, Matt.
That's the vibe, though. No, I mean, absolutely.
So great.
I don't even joke. That's
Aaron, thank you for being here. We have to thank our fabulous people behind the scenes. Marlo Shankweiler is our producer. Thank you for producing, Marlo Shankweiler. You are the best. We wish you could be here in this beautiful home thinking about all the drilling and the teeth that are happening downstairs. And our boy, Brian Brinkman, RJB, all of the fine folks at the Osiris Network, thank you for putting us on. And, you know, holy shit, man. It's fucking longest episode to date because we were really going in. This is a, you know, generally speaking, they call it a snackable podcast.
Is that what they refer to it as?
They call it snackable.
Oh, I like that because I don't like the hour and a half long podcast. I can't get into those.
We never do it. But
it also seems like there's like a half hour of commercials before the hour and a half podcast too. So
right. So you have to scroll. You're scrolling. You're scrubbing. What do they call it? Scrolling, scrubbing. Unbelievable. But no, this is usually snackable. But we had to go pretty deep with you here. So thank you for really just getting into the sauce.
Yeah, guys.
The real shit with us. And dude, we're gonna have a great fish show tonight. For those of you listening, we're recording on Wednesday afternoon, so there is a whole new fish show this evening that we're not going to talk about on this podcast. You know why? Because it
hasn't happened yet.
It hasn't happened yet. That's exactly why. Good times, y'all. Good times. We wish you a wonderful rest of the week. Thank you for tuning in. Isaac Sloan, you're my dude.
Aaron.
Magna, amazing. Thank you for being here.
Thank you both.
And for those of you listening, goodbye.
Goodbye. Take care.
Osiris.
Hey, this is Steve Choi, host of the Musicians Guild podcast, part of the Sound Talent Media podcast network. Within the four walls of the Musicians Guild, we'll be discussing the habits, idiosyncrasies, experiences, and general psychology of my friends and peers all involved with music in various capacities. Listen and subscribe at soundtalentmedia.com.
Hey, this is Dewey Halpas, host of Peer Pleasure on the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. Join me each week as I explore another long-form conversation with one of your favorite musicians, actors, comedians, or creatives. From Chino Moreno of the Deftones, John Gorley of Portugal the Man, to Fat Mike from NoFX and Ian MacKay from Fugazi and Minor Threat, we go all over the map. From Fall Out Boy to Slayer, Peer Pleasure has it all. Check us out now on Sound Talent Media.